don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your hosts, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The Streets Don't Love You Back. I gotta do right before they call
me home. Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is February 20th, 2013. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, The Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. Our topic is Reaching Through the Cracks of the System with Leon Benson's Struggle for Freedom. Leon was falsely accused of a crime of murder, and he's, after 13 years, still trying to get out of prison. So we're going to have several special guests tonight. And so, you know, as we bring them on, we'll introduce a little bit about them, and then we'll bring them on. So listen closely. We'll give the last four numbers of your number, and we'll bring you on the air. And we're hoping to have a special guest call in from Mr. Benson himself in a little bit. So before we do all that, let me welcome Boyd to the show.
Yeah, I would just like to thank everybody who tunes into our radio show every Wednesday night. And we would just like to give a big, big shout-out to all our soldiers and 150 prisons across the country, federal and state, men and women. We always like to give them a shout-out because they're behind the walls educating our youth that's on their way back home. And we would just like to give a shout-out to all our members out here in the street as well. And without further ado, I would like to have my main man formally introduce himself. And this is my man, Mr. Bentley.
I need his number.
Yeah, 317, area code, last 3211.
Hold on, here he comes. And welcome to the show.
My man,
hey,
Leon.
How you doing? Hey, man, you know, I thank y'all for having me. I went through a bit of a problem with the administration with calling through on the phone, so, you know, it's good. You know, I'm in the dormitory, so I'm out, and I get to talk to you guys. You know, it's really a blessing, you know?
That's
without
awesome.
Doubt, man. We're glad to have you here, man. And without further ado, we would like you to just straight up formally introduce yourself, and let's get started about this injustice, my man.
Okay. Hey, I really appreciate y'all having me. To the viewers out there and the listeners, my name is Leon Benson. I'm 37 years old. Well, my situation starts back in 1998 when I was arrested on August 14th of 1998 for a crime I didn't commit. Just to give you some backdrop, I'm originally from Flint, Michigan. And, you know, that's where I grew up at, you know, typical, you know, background, urban background. I grew up in a two-parent household. They tried to make do with the things they had, you know. They tried to show me the best that they could, you know, from their background. You know, children of sharecroppers, a son of a shop worker in Flint, Michigan. And, you know, I grew up, you know, in the ranks, you know, in the streets, and I was introduced to a lot of things early on that, you know, a lot of youth, you know, shouldn't see. But I can't use that as an excuse, you know, for my decisions, but it did affect some of my decisions, and particularly to get involved into the street life. Growing up, you know, I had several siblings. My sister Val, my sister Siobhan, my brother Rod, my sister Rhonda in Alabama. And, you know, we really loved each other, you know, despite, you know, some of the social and economical conflicts that we had growing up. As I progressed, you know, into the street life, you know. I moved through school, you know. I had an early interest in education and the arts. You know, my parents introduced me to that, ironically. But as I moved towards, like, middle school, the streets started to really, you know, suck me in. And I started to really be a disciple of the streets and of the drug dealers, of the gangsters, of the gangbangers, things of that nature. And because of that, you know, I made bad decisions, and I ended up dropping out of high school in the ninth grade. And that was one of my bad points, you know, in my life that starts this particular journey off and pushed me into a chaotic encounter with, you know, many obstacles and hardships. So from there, you know, I'm bouncing around in the streets. I moved off to Detroit, and, you know, I'm down there. You know, I'm working for a while, and before you know it, I'm back in the streets again, you know, doing what came second nature to me, which was hustling. And long story short, you know, I kind of got tired of the hustling and the stuff like that, and I moved back to Flint, and I ended up bumping into my uncle who was moving to Indianapolis. This, you know, let's do a fast forward. This is 1995. So I'm helping him move to Indianapolis. And when we get down to Indianapolis, when I'm there after I moved in, another uncle approached me with a job opportunity to be a professional painter. And I went on the scene of the job. They was painting a Marriott Hotel. I jumped in. The guy that was heading the company, he really liked my work, and I worked there for a week. My first paycheck was like $1,600, you know. So I was like, wow, you know. And I'm comparing, you know, Indianapolis, Indiana, to the economy and the hustle and bustle of Detroit and Flint, Michigan. And it wasn't a comparison to me. I was like, wow, man, hey, this is a chance for me to get away from that life. So I stayed down there and worked the job, and as fate has it, you know, I bumped into a woman, and we ended up having children together. So I stayed, you know, in Indianapolis and, you know, doing my thing, working my job. And, you know, my mom, she was proud of me. You know, my brothers and sisters, they liked, you know, my new start. It was a beautiful thing. But, you know, after a year later, I was laid off. Now, I had money and stuff, you know. I wasn't broke, anything like that. You know, I was taking care of my family. But, you know, I ended up back in the street life. You know, I met some good people in Indianapolis. There's no doubt about that. Some good brothers and sisters down there in Indianapolis. These brothers and sisters, they embraced me like I was one of their brothers and one of their siblings. And they really showed me genuine love. But they was lost like me. They was lost like me. We was all like street disciples. I hung around them every day. And they was doing their thing, you know. They was selling drugs and, you know, drinking and smoking weed, you know, talking the latest ish, you know. And I was right along in that crowd. So, hey, you know, we started doing our thing. We started getting money, you know. I'm with the clique. We doing it. They loving it, you know. And they gave me a nickname. They called me Detroit. You know, I didn't like the name at first, you know. People from the area, I'm like, man, don't call me, I'm from Flint, don't call me Detroit, you know. But, you know, that's the name that stuck, you know, in that particular area. Outside of that area, everybody called me Lee. So, you know, this is where it began. I'm in the streets in this particular area, in the near downtown area, Indianapolis. And as time goes, you know, I'm making more money. I don't want to turn away, you know. I don't want to turn away from this life. I let the greed get a hold of me, you know. And I'm chasing, you know, this fallacy of, you know, I'm going to get out the game, you know, I'm going to make it real big. I'm living out this Scarface fantasy that a lot of us live out that's from those parts. I'm living out an illusion, not knowing it, you know, to myself. And ironically, it was a brother that was amongst a group of individuals, you know, that we used to get money together, a brother by the name of Bobby Cole. This brother, man, he stopped cold turkey. He's like, man, he said, look, Leon, man, I'm through with this street stuff, man. I'm finna go get me a job, and I'm cool. You know, I laughed at this brother. I'm like, man, you're crazy, man. You're going to turn away all this money, man? We making money hand over fist, baby. You know when you're going to turn it, you're going to turn it down? And he did. And he did, you know. And when I look back on that, that was one of the bravest things that I seen, that I experienced somebody do. Because he stepped away while he was in the middle of it. And that was a big move. And he escaped. But I still there. I was trapped with everybody else. So long story short, we're going to fast forward to August 14th, 1998. No. Let me take it back to August 8th, 1998, because this is the day of the crime. So this particular day, you know, I'm out and about. I'm in the area, and I'm making money, you know. This is my mission, you know. I'm a fiend for this money, you know. I'm out there, I'm getting it, and, you know, hey, I get up about 8 o'clock, and I'm out there all day, and I'm making money. I'm in the area. I got several buildings. One particular building that I was in, it goes by the name of Vietnam. This was the name of this building before I even manifested in the city of Indianapolis. It was given this name because it was so rugged and treacherous down there. You know, only a few, you know, guys can go down there, you know, and get money without, you know, being robbed or, you know, even murdered, you know. But, you know, I was making it down there, you know, and I was in that building, you know, doing my thing. I'm running all day back and forth throughout the whole area, the near downtown area, through several buildings, making money. And before I know it, you know, it's nightfall, and I'm like, you know, I'm down on my energy from running all day, so I'm really ready to stop and, you know, really, you know, leave it alone for that day. And it was a Friday. It was drizzling outside at first. And what I done was I went to my apartment that I had in the area located on Eastern St. Clair Street, and I put on a Nike windbreaker, long sleeve, hoodie, nylon. I had on a Pelly Pale shirt, Pelly Pale pants, some Air Max, you know. And, you know, I'm back in the area, back and forth, doing my thing. And at around, I would say around about 10:30, one of the comrades, he appeared, you know, on the scene with me, a brother by the name of Timothy Gaither. Now, the thing about Timothy Gaither, he wasn't out there getting money with me at the time. He didn't care about money. This brother right here, he was keeping a dream of hip-hop alive with me. You know, he would come on the set and, you know, we would rap, you know, for hours, you know. With him, he kept that dream alive. You know, that was one of my dreams, is to grab the microphone and rock the stage. And his brother, you know, this is what he loved to do. And when we was kicking it like that, you know, that whole day, he just kicking verses while, you know, I'm out there, you know, selling packages and stuff. We eventually went and got some beers and stuff like that and settled down in Vietnam in the back. And we doing our thing, you know, drinking, I'm making money. It's in the wee hours. It's like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, we winding down. We about ready to go. Then all of a sudden, boom, 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 boom. We hear these shots. We like, whoa, you know. And we in the midst of doing our thing in the back, you know, handing out packages and making money. And somebody, you know, trying to come in the entrance, they jump back. You know, it seemed like the shots was right outside the building. So, you know, we paused for a minute. You know, we had people investigate around the building. We didn't see nothing. So we went back to what we was doing. I know to some people that it sound like, you know, we didn't care. We were savage. But when you go up in them areas like that, you become desensitized to sirens and gunshots, you know. The only reason why we acted the way we did because it sounded like it was right around us, you know. But we went back to what we was doing like it was nothing. About 30 minutes later, I called it a night, walked to my apartment, which was right around the corner, pretty much, walked around, you know, to my apartment and crashed for the night, me and Timothy Gaither, you know. I let him crash, you know, in my living room. I, you know, went to my back room, crashed out. And, you know, I woke up the next day, and I go back, you know, to the area because I made so much money that night. You know, it was incredible. You know, it was tragic, too, at the same time because I made $15,000. I made $15,000 that night that I heard them shots. And I had dreams of being some kingpin. You know, I was looking up to my idols. That was like from Detroit and Flint, the Juice Williams and the Butch Jones and, you know, these other cliques. You know, I was looking up to them and I wanted to be that. And that's what I said. I said, man, I've done this by myself. You know, I can do anything. You know, my imagination, it was stagnated. My imagination was held captive because that's what I thought I could only be, was a drug dealer. And that's what I wanted to be at that time. So when I got up that morning, I went back to the area, and I'm looking around. I'm like, hey, it got to be some more money. But it was quiet. It was real subtle, eerie even. Me and Tim Dog, we went through the buildings, Vietnam, and it was nothing. Nobody was moving. I was like, wow. And we went to another building called the St. Regis's where we bumped into a woman by the name of Carol Knight, as I know her now, but back then I just knew her as mom and pops with her husband. You know, I used to visit them, and I buy food and stuff from them while I was out there doing my thing. So when I went to their apartment talking to them, that's when they told me somebody was murdered. Somebody was murdered on that corner, and I was like, wow. You know, I heard those shots. And I was like, who did it? It's like, I don't know. And they give the description that the perpetrator had on all black and white stripes. And they tell me about a Star News lady who witnessed it all. And I was like, wow, you know, why would somebody do something that dumb in a place where we made money? You know, we got to be logical people. And I'm giving you the real. Why would somebody do something so dumb in a place where you make money at? This is my thinking. Yeah, I was a capitalist. I was a capitalist at the time, you know, so that was my thinking. So I go on about my business, and I'm like, dang, you know, the days to follow the police really infested the area. Come to find out, it was a 23-year-old Caucasian male by the name of Casey Shane who was shot down. Maybe because of the color of his skin, the police had an extra special interest in the case. And they was on it. They was in the whole area. Nothing could move. So I had to stay away from the area for a couple of days. I couldn't come through and sell. That's all I did there was sell, you know. It was nobody looking for me. I didn't have no worries about anybody looking for me because I didn't do nothing. I didn't even remotely have it in my mind, you know, again. I don't want y'all to feel like, you know, I was some bad guy, but at this point of my life, you know, growing up in Flint, Michigan, Detroit, and now in Indianapolis in the streets, I was kind of desensitized to the things that was happening out there, you know, people being murdered. You're like, wow, like somebody dead today. I'm just glad it's not me. You know, I'm still moving. So from that point, you know, I stayed away until, like, August 14th, where I had this. Now I'm like, man, I got to see what's going on in the area, and I'm finna cop some more drugs. This time I'm finna get, you know, a half a kilo, and I'm waiting on my connect. You know, they playing me the whole day, and ain't nobody coming through, and I'm sitting in my apartment. I'm bored. I'm playing PlayStation. I didn't clean my whole house up. And I'm like, man, I didn't count all my money, you know. I'm like 80 racks or what they would say, 80,000 to the good. I'm like, wow, you know, I'm going to get some more. I'm going to try to get some more money. So what happened when I sat in the house all day, my connect didn't come, I said, let me go out and see what, you know, my homies and them doing. And they stayed in the area. At the time, the reason why I was walking around because my car had got seized in a high-speed chase. You know, I put a lot of money in one of them BS cars, you know, riding around, bumping my music loud, you know, peacocking. Didn't know no better, you know, like a lot of these brothers out there that's doing the same thing right now. I was one of them, and I got my car took it in a high speed, and I got away, you know. So I was walking. So I walked, you know, to my homeboy crib, you know, right around the corner. He wasn't there. Casimiro. And I walked to my other homie crib, Bobby Call. He wasn't there. I just couldn't find nobody. I couldn't catch up with nobody. So I ended up, you know, walking back, you know, in the area, you know, in the crime area. And I sat in front of the apartment building of my uncle, Clee girlfriend apartment. And I sat there and I was smoking marijuana and I was drinking on alcohol and, you know, I bumped into a Shirley Gaskin, as I know her now, and Shirley Gaskin and two other individuals that was in the area. And they sat down with me. We talked. They was telling me about the police around this and that. And one of the guys pulled me to the side. He said, "Hey, Detroit, hey, man, let me holler at you, man." I'm like, "Okay." He said, "Hey, man, where that money at, man, I gave you, man? What you talking about?" This is what I say. So I'm like, "What you talking about? Man, I gave you $40, man, last week, man, and you ain't come back." And I looked at him, and I'm like, "Dang, you know what? You're right. And what happened was, you know, in the midst of me hustling and bustling out there, you know, the man gave me $40 for some drugs when I was on my way to the liquor store. And when I came back, I didn't see him. So I went back to Little Vietnam where everybody in the area know where I be at. And I didn't see the cat. $40. $40. You know, $40. I mean, come on. You know, I ain't trying to get nobody for $40, you know. But at the time, you know, I didn't have the money on me because I was kind of tight. I was kind of tight, you know, but I was smart, you know, because I come out and why am I have a whole bunch of money on me when I ain't spending none? You know, that was stupid to me. You just asking yourself to be robbed or something. So I never was like that, you know, flashing a lot of money. So I just came out with my immediate spending cash and that's it. So I didn't have the money. So I told him, I said, "Look, man, just come here tomorrow. I got you." You know, I was willing to give him the amount of drugs that exceeded his $40 four times, you know, just to prove a point, you know. He said, "All right, man, you know, Shirley Gaskin at the time, she vouched for me like, yeah, you know, Detroit, good people. You know, he's been over here, you know, for years, you know." And, you know, dude walked off. He was happy. So I sat down, me and Shirley, just sitting there, just outside, basically, you know, and the police pulls up. Now, they arrested me, but they didn't arrest me for murder. There was nothing said about murder. They arrested me because I had a probation violation for petty possession. So I'm taken to the precinct, and they put me in a room. I'm intoxicated, and I pass out. A few hours later, I'm woke up. And I'm being questioned by police. And they questioned me, and they accused me of murder. They said, "Hey, you know, we got witnesses that say they saying you murdered Casey Shane." I'm like, "Man, who was Casey Shane at the time? I don't know this guy. You know, I don't know no Casey Shane. What you talking about? You talking about that murder that happened on Pennsylvania and 14th? Yeah, you know where I said, yeah, you done that." I'm like, "Wow." This is what I'm thinking. I'm like, "Man, these police, they'd do anything to try to get at me because they can't get me selling drugs. They just want to find a way to get at me selling drugs because they can't be trying to pin a murder on me. This is what I'm thinking." And, you know, they go on and on and talk. Now, this right here is critical, and this is what I advise everybody, you know, out there in the streets, whether you in the streets or whether you're just a regular citizen. This is something you should exercise, your right to remain silent. Now, for me, because I was innocent, and they come to me with these accusations, I say, look, it was people in a building where I was at. You can go there. Now, the thing about it, though, I omitted, you know, several facts. You know, I didn't tell the police I was in the building selling drugs. Of course not. No, I'm going to tell them that. But I was in that building. Those people seen me, and I gave them names of the people that was there. But they take my statement. They arrest me. They say, we got an eyewitness that said they seen you. Come to find out, the Star News delivery woman, a Caucasian woman, had picked me out of a photo array while I was at the police station. I mean, why a photo array? I'm in custody. Let's do a live lineup. Now, come to find out, this woman's description of the suspect was 5'8", all black T-shirt, black jogging pants, white stripes down the side, black shoes, and dark complected. And she viewed this crime from 50 yards away at night. And this is the description she gave on the scene to the police 30 minutes after the crime. This is the description she gave to 911 tapes when she called 911. This is the description that she gave to the police at the police station the same day of the crime. But here it is, 6 days later, August 14th, she picked me out of a photo array, a light-complected African-American male at 5'10". You know, light-complected. I almost can be a Puerto Rican. You know, all my people are light-complected peoples. Because, you know, as you know, the mixture, you know, of America and, you know, probably, you know, some of the rape of African women and things like that, you know, back in those Reconstruction days and days of slavery. But, hey, whatever the case, you know, I'm a light-skinned brother, you know, and I can't go for dark-skinned, you know. But she picked me out of a photo array. The next day, the guy who asked me about the drugs, he was the one who sicked the police on me, I found out. He said the person you're looking for that did the murder is around the corner sitting on, you know, sitting in front of that apartment building. He sicked the police on me. And he gave a statement the day after on August 15th, basically saying that he seen me on the scene of the crime, and he didn't see nothing, though, but I was on the scene of the crime, me and several other people. Though that contradicted the other witness who said it was just one person on the scene that she see, you know, shooting into the truck that was parked in front of the community center or whatnot. It was a lot of contradictions. So, you know, I go down to the county jail, you know, I'm feeling it, I'm going through it. And, you know, the first thing I thought it just was a scare tactic. Come on, they don't got nothing. They tripping. They lying. They just trying to get me to say, you know, I sell drugs or something. This is what I'm thinking. But as the time went on, 3 weeks, I'm like, well, maybe I need to get a lawyer. So I try to reach out and get a lawyer, Michael Cordell, you know, call, left some messages. My kid's mother at the time, she was a big supporter of mine. You know, she was in my corner at the time and in control of a lot of my finances and stuff like that. So we reached out to the lawyer and stuff like that, and they never would call back. And lo and behold, I got an attorney visit in the jail. And when I got the visit, I mean, I just assumed that it was Michael Cordell. But when I got in there, it was an attorney named Timothy J. Miller. And he kind of got me, y'all, because I'm innocent. I'm innocent. See, when you're innocent, sometimes it's worse than being guilty, because you're almost naive, because you believe in injustice, like, you know, it's guilty until proven, it's innocence until proven guilty. This is what you're saying, but the presumption is just the opposite. It's guilty until proven innocent. So because of my naiveness, you know, this particular process or whatnot, you know, this guy come through, he say he knew a little bit about my case. He like, man, it sounds like You know, they going to just drop the charges. They're just trying to scare you. Well, just lay $5,000 on me, and we'll go ahead and get this case dismissed, and we'll get you on up out of here, Leon, you know? And I'm like, bet, you know, I dropped the money on him. I'm ready to go. And about a month later, you know, I don't hear nothing. I'm like, man, where this cat at? Then he finally comes in and say, look, man, they got eyewitnesses and everything, and you got to go to trial, man. This is going to be a tough case. And come to find out, he pulled a real savvy persuasion technique that's called the foot in the door. See, once I gave my $5,000 to him, I felt like I need to just go all the way with this guy, you know. I already got $5,000, you know, invested in him. I might as well go all the way. I'm innocent, too. So, you know, that's what I done. So, long story short, to get to the trial, we ended up, you know, getting to the trial. And it was a week before the trial where I discovered that it was a statement by another witness who's seen somebody else commit the crime. And they described the same clothing that the Star News witness described. But this person said that they seen the shooter an hour before the crime. And he asked the shooter, what is that you got over your hands, you know? And this particular eyewitness, he said the shooter pulled out a gun. And he described the gun. He said it was a 380 automatic. In his statement, the detective said, how did you know what type of gun it was? He said, because I own one myself. It's a 380. Now, when we look at these facts, this corroborates with the existing evidence. The victim in this case was killed with a 380 automatic. 5 bullet shells were found on the scene. And another witness had already described the clothing. He said this is the clothing this guy had on. And then later on, this same eyewitness witnessed this person shoot in the truck where Casey Shane was found dead. Also, there was Crime Stopper reports that was saying a particular individual, which turns out to be the same person that this eyewitness possibly identified as being a shooter. Somebody else came forward in the Crime Stopper saying this is the same guy that done his crime, and he used his girlfriend's gun. And ironically, it was a police report of this particular woman of a 380 automatic being stolen. This was out. And this, and my so-called lawyer at the time, he showed me this a week before trial. So I'm happy. I'm like, wow, not knowing the process because I've never been through a murder trial. So I'm happy. I'm elated. And I'm like, man, I'm going to go home. I come back to the cell block. I show everybody, man, look, bro, I'm going to go home. I told you I was innocent, man. This ain't on the proof. But we go to trial. But we don't call this exculpatory eyewitness. We don't call him. He say, man, we can't find him. This is what the trial lawyer said. We can't find him. So we're going to go on. However, Mr. Gaither, alibi witness, he testified, Carol Knight, Shirley King, she testified of what they seen and what I was wearing and, you know, who was with me at the time, which was Gaither. And what happened is it was a hung jury. It was 5 guilty, 6 for not guilty, and 1 undecided. This, just with the mere mention of this exculpatory witness that wasn't called. And I heard the jurors, when they come out the deliberating room, like, wow, we probably would have found him innocent if they would have brought forth this other witness. Where he at? Why they didn't bring him forward, but they mentioned him? So at this point, when we going into the second trial, I consulted, you know, with my brother Rod. You know, I consulted with him, with my kid's mother and stuff like that. And I'm like, we need to find somebody that can go in the community, in the urban black community, to find this witness. you know, because obviously the trial lawyers, private investigator wasn't doing the job. And what happened was I hired James Hendricks. He was a black private investigator, heard about him in county jail. You know, he'd done good work, so I hired him. And my trial lawyer, he was elated, like, wow, that's a good choice. Yeah, go, Leon, you know. And, you know, this dude, he go out and he say he can't find nobody. He came and visited me once after looking, and he told me, he said, man, the only way you can get out of this is the person who did it come back and admit they did it. I was like, wow, can't find this witness. Lo and behold, unbeknownst to me at the time, this eyewitness was in state custody the whole time. Ironically, just down the street from where the crime happened, in work release, in a place called Riverside Work Release. This is where he was at the whole time. So the state had to know where he was at. I'm willing to believe that the trial attorney knew where he was at, and obviously the private investigator knew where he was at, because protocol would tell any logical person that's a private investigator or anybody investigating any criminal case looking for witnesses that the first place you check is the state's custody for the witness. So they knew where he was at, but everybody sandbagged it. And we went into that second trial just like that, without that witness. And in the second trial, things really got funky. They really, really got funky. My trial lawyer, he just seemed like he was real, you know, he was moving like a sloth, in a sense, like he didn't want to be there. And, you know, he was antagonistic, you know, to me and to my family, things like that. So his performance was way below the standards of what he'd done in the first trial. So much so that the particular state's witness I told y'all about, that the drug user, Donald Brooks, he refused to testify. The state dismissed him. And the prosecutor admitted an out-of-court statement into evidence, and my lawyer didn't object. Not only did he not object, he allowed the prosecutor to read the statement to the jurors, which were filled with a bunch of lies, and it was terrible. Uncharged crimes, accusations, and this went before the jury, prosecutor mouth. So this had a great impact on the jurors, coming from the prosecutor mouth, as this got to be the truth. And also, despite the fact that we had Shirley Gaskin that came back, but we didn't have Timothy Gaither come testify in the second trial. For what reason, I don't know. We had a real good, it still was strong. The lone state's eyewitness, her testimony was contradictory, as it was from the start. But it was kind of eerie, because while she was on the stand being cross-examined, she was asked several times, didn't you say that the person that you saw commit that crime was a dark-skinned person? What color is the defendant? She said he's light-skinned. And another crucial thing she said that really contradicted herself, because 7 months after the crime, she made an accusation that she made eye contact with the shooter before he ran behind the community center. Well, the prosecutor asked her, he said, Miss Smith, he said, what made you want to get to your vehicle? Because she was loading the papers at the time when the crime happened. She said, I was in fear that the shooter was going to come back from around the building. I didn't want to be there for my safety. You know, he was behind the building. But how can a shooter be behind a building 50 yards away while you in your vehicle, but you make eye contact with him before he turned into a parking lot? Well, because of my trial attorney performance and the tactics of the prosecution, things of that nature, I was convicted. You know, I was mortified. I heard my mother crying people cheered. They cheered. You know, it was real mortifying. They cheered for my guilt, for a crime I didn't commit. Only thing I can do is yell, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. But guess what, y'all? Jesus didn't come. I'm like, wow. Look at my family. Look at my bro. Look at my sister. Look at my kids. Look at my kids' mother. It was taken away. All I seen was faces taunting me. They was happy to see me go down. They cheered for my downfall, for something I didn't do. So I had my head down. But before I went back, I looked at them. I said, look, I didn't do this crime. They laughed. They said, get out of here. Get out of here. My people snuck. My people snuck in the courtroom because they was intimidated. They was intimidated by a whole panel of rude people who were deceived. I'm not mad at those people because they were deceived by public officials, the police, the prosecution, the judge. They were deceived by these people that they were supposed to trust, and they trusted in a system. So they thought that they had the right guy. Also, during the course of the trial, Indianapolis had 162 homicides in 1998-99. This was a record high for the city of Indianapolis. There was a lot of pressure on the prosecution office. There was a lot of pressure on the police department to solve these cases, to get them off the books, to let people know that they meant business. And I believe I was caught up in this dragnet of sorts of we need to get these cases off the books. And, you know, it was a long road, you know, and that's what started my journey into prison, things like that. I entered prison for the first time. I'm 23 years old. And I'm like, wow, you know, this is where they want me to be for 60 years. They sentenced me to 60 years. So I enter Wabash Valley. You know, ironically, you know, on the ride to prison at the time, Martin Lawrence had a movie out, him and Eddie, called Life. And it was an LP off there by Casey and JoJo called How Did I Get Life? Y'all, don't you know that that was playing on the radio when I'm riding to prison? I'm like, wow. How ironic is this, man? And I'm going, how did I get life? Life, life. And I go in, I go to prison, I see the gates open up, and it seemed like a mouth of a beast was opening up just to swallow me whole. And I get in there, and I go in there, and I go to the cell where I had a cellie at the time, and I'm sitting there, and I'm going through it. I'm in denial. I'm like, no, this can't be. They tripping. They going to come get me. They going to come get me. They tripping. Come on, man. Hey, they going to come get me. You know what? I ain't going to take my coat off. They going to come get me. This can't be real. But it was real. It sunk in. Eventually, I had to accept the fact that I was in prison. I had to fight out. So we started the appeal process. My brother, you know, he was real instrumental in helping me with the appeal process. We hired a good lawyer by the name of Richard Kiefer, you know, out of Indianapolis. He was a wonderful direct appeal lawyer. So that you guys know how the process works. And this goes for any state, let alone Indiana. Well, the judicial process works like this. Once you are found guilty or you convicted of a crime, your next move is to have a direct appeal. Depending on your sentence, if you get more than 60 years, your case will be heard by the state Supreme Court. If it's less than that, it'll be heard by the state's appeal court. Now, when you're appealing in a direct appeal stage, the court will only go with the evidence that's presented by the state. So then, you know, however you was found guilty, they just write it up like, this is why you're guilty, because this person seen this crime and you done it. But their main focus is fundamental errors, and that's where you present fundamental errors. You don't present ineffective assistance of counsel or bring up new evidence at this stage. This is just fundamental errors that can be found in the record, so to speak. And, you know, we presented a good appeal, very good appeal, prosecutorial misconduct. It was a remark by the judge who made me be the shooter. You know, she showed her biasness, you know, in the trial. And the other issue was, I can't think of it right now, y'all, but it's in the record, Leon Benson versus Indiana, 2001. It's in the case law, but these was the issues presented, and my appeal was in for a long time. I had a lot of hope. I had tragic optimism, probably, you know, because I was innocent. I just knew that they was going to let me go. So in the course of me waiting on this appeal, another strange thing happened. I was working in the kitchen, and I was called into a counselor office by the internal affairs. And when I get to the counselor's office, you know, it was in the cell house right outside the kitchen area, it was a detective. He said, "How you doing, Mr. Benson?" I'm like, "Wow, you know, who is you?" And he immediately bring out these pictures, like, "Look, this was a guy that was murdered in the area. We found your pager number, you know, in his pocket. Oh, yeah, we know you didn't do it, you know, or nothing. But we think we know, you know, who done it." And they pull out a picture of who? The guy that the exculpatory witness picked out of a photo rating and said he did it. The same guy that Crime Stoppers pointed to. He was in the photo. They were trying to get me to lie on this person because they knew they railroaded me to prison. So they tried to pit me against him. They like, "This guy in prison for something he didn't do. I know you want some revenge. Go ahead, man. Just point this guy out. You can get some get back, man, you know? Call my lawyer. Call my lawyer, man. I'm out of here." You know, this is what I tell the detective. I walk out. The IA, he was mad about that. He was mad, you know, and I think he had a special eye on me. Also, I found out that the victim's family had a lot of pull in Indiana DOC, and I seen that when I was coming through the processing, where I was approached by two guards, Caucasian guards, over 6 feet. You know, "Why you kill my cousin? Why you kill my cousin? You killed my cousin. You gonna rot in prison." You know, we almost came to blows, you know. It was really, you know, they was on my trail. I was like, "Wow, what am I in? Is this a real nightmare?" And it was. So when I get to prison, this is how the IA come to me. So, you know, I'm in there, you know, I'm going to college while I'm in prison. I'm like, "Let me go to college, you know." I'm checking myself because even though I'm innocent, I say it's a reason why I'm in here, and it starts with me. This is the first thing I thought. I was like, maybe I was, look how I was acting. I was arrogant. Only thing I thought about was, you know, getting money and stuff like that. So, you know, I started to change my ways. You know, I seen that it was a dialectic to it, a cause and effect, you know, that can create an atmosphere. And I was calling myself an MC once upon a time, not knowing that MC means master of ceremonies. And this goes for your life, too. With the things that you do and how you do it, you can create an atmosphere. And I created an atmosphere that was conducive to me to be falsely convicted in prison. Had I not been in the street life, hanging out, doing what I did, I wouldn't have been accused of this crime. Had I not been arrogant, throwing my money around, maybe, you know, less people would have hated me or something, you know. And, you know, more people would have came up, hey, and spoke up for me, you know. Had I done other things and chose to go to school and chose to be a better father, I wouldn't have ended up in this situation. These are the choices I have to live with despite the fact I am falsely in prison. These are the things that I've done myself. So I'm trying to better myself while I'm in prison. And on August 21st, 2001, a prison riot happened. Several guards, you know, they was brutalized, you know. You know, and I sat and seen the whole thing, like, from the top tier. I was on my way in the shower. Look, innocent on me, huh? And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, wow, you know. they getting crushed, you know, but they brought it on themselves in a sense. Now, the administration, they rushed people immediately to the shoe who they thought was involved. Definitely they didn't come get me. Then an investigation ensued where, you know, internal affairs came and questioned people in the cell house and what they see. Now they come get me. They said, "You see anything?" I said, "Hell no. I didn't see nothing. And if I did, I wouldn't say nothing anyway. Hey, look, this little meeting is over with. I don't got nothing to say to y'all." Now, the thing, people, is this. It ain't what you do. It's how you do it. And I think, man, I had a rotten attitude towards authority. And I went back to my cell. Lo and behold, 2 months later, why did they come get me with a CI statement saying they seen me stomp somebody out? Yes, immediately to the shoe. This was November 5th, 2001. I'm immediately in the shoe. So when this happened, again, I'm like, man, how am I? But wait, I'm falsely in prison. Now I'm falsely in prison in a prison's prison. I lose out on my college education. I was loving it. I mean, 4.0. I never knew I was like that smart, right? You never know until you really, like, try, you know?
That's right.
Like, wow. And I lost out on this stuff. And this is when the tragedy of the prison life came tumbling down on me. The next month, December, somebody raped my baby sister. They raped my queen sister. There's nothing I can do. It was my fault. I made these choices. It's my fault. I went out there to protect her. They raped her. There's nothing I can do but send a letter. Condolences, you know. I'm like, wow. Then that 2002, the January, my stepfather died. I'm like, wow. Man, all this is going on at once. I mean, can it get any worse? The next month, February 2002, my granddaddy died. Whoa. Can it get any worse? The same month, my direct appeal gets denied. You know, I'm looking. I'm like, is this real? Wait, the counselor can come in and give me the paperwork. Man, your appeal has been denied. I'm like, wow. Can it get any worse? My kid's mother, the woman I loved and I wanted to be with, she showed herself approved for me during my time incarcerated and stuff like that. And I could have been a better companion to her. You know, I was young, though. You know, she's like 10 years my senior and whatnot. But, you know, I thought she was dead. We had a full takeout business and everything. But when it came time for me to say, "Do you got that money for that appeal lawyer?" I don't got it. And I sat right there. That was the time that was going to make or break me. Because I'm sitting in the shoe. I'm isolated and solitary. It ain't no love. Only thing I'm hearing is racial slurs. I'm smelling feces, people throwing feces on each other. I'm hearing all these different derogatory terms thrown around. The guards cussing me out, playing with my food, telling me, "Hey, we gonna beat you. We gonna beat you like you beat our buddies." I'm like, I ain't even do nothing to y'all. They hate me, you know. I'm just in the corner. I'm broken to pieces. People ain't feeling me, though. People ain't feeling me at this time. I'm writing letters. I ain't getting responses. It's like, wow, what's going on? And that was the make and break, you know, Leon Benson time, but during that time, even though, you know, I kind of stazzed out in a sense, I rejected God. I'm like, "God, why me? Why me, God? Why me?" This is what I said. I said, "You know what? It can't be a God. God wouldn't let me go through nothing like this. Nah, he know I'm innocent. But why he let me go through this?" This is what I said. So I rejected. But what I did was, I bettered myself. I said, everything that I was weak on, I'm going to get better. I studied, like, philosophies of SWOT, his strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And I looked at the classics and literature, history, politics, law, and I consumed it. I consumed it like it was breath I never had. It was right before my face when I was in society, but it didn't make sense to me. But it made sense to me now because I had nothing to hold on to. It ain't no guns. It ain't when you can't go get your buddy. Ain't nobody going to help you. You got to help yourself. They will not help you. You got to help yourself. It ain't no love. I seen then and I knew then. Streets don't love you back. They don't love you back. It ain't no love. And I went through, you know, this thing. I was kind of bitter, but I was going at the same time. And when I was on my way getting out, the shoe in the end of 2001, they sat up and detoured me to administrative AS, which is still solitary, but deeming that I was a security threat. And, you know, here we go again, you know. I didn't have no money. I probably had like $100 to my name. And what I done was I put together an advert, and I put it on the Internet, and I declared, you know, my freedom. It was hard for me because I'm a breadwinner. I'm a breadwinner, you know. You know, all my life, you know, I go out there and get it, you know, whether it's settling snow, mowing grass, painting houses, cleaning gutters, you know, as a kid. I mean, all the way to the point where I was doing some illicit hustling. But I always got it. But I couldn't get it then, and it really hurt me to have to reach out to the world and say, can you help me? I felt like a Jerry's kid. I went from a baller to a collect caller. Who does that? That's how I felt. But the reality of it was, this is what I was faced with. So I put that advert in and waited on replies. But in the meantime, I moved to AS. And luckily, I bumped into a range of real good brothers. I bumped into a brother by the name of William O.J. Johnson. He also was falsely convicted, but he was doing his time. He was on the shoe 5 years. And, you know, he had a deep perspective, deep spiritual perspective. I bumped into another brother while on his unit by the name of Walter Kareem Gowdy, who was a little older. He was OG. He was from California. And he was like on his like 14th year, 13th year of a 110-year sentence for a double murder he didn't do. And we would talk, you know. And they was kind of, you know, they was a couple years older than me, Kareem being older. I met another brother, Bilal Bukhari, Black Man of Noble Cause, as he used to say. These people became my teachers because they were authentic. They was genuine. They felt my struggle. They knew what I was going through. We put our heads together and studied the law, studied history, and it was a genuine growth there, you know. It was a rapid growth. Probably the growth that I experienced in that time in the shoe, in this form of gestation. And it's form of gestation. That's what it is. It's a form of gestation while you're in a shoe, because it's like a womb, like you're in the womb of a beast. And you know, the longest gestation period of any mammal on earth is an elephant. That's 23 months. But when you put on administrative segregation, you can be there indefinitely. So you don't know when you're going to get out. But you gestating in there, you know. You're developing. You know, you can be de-evolving too, but I was evolving, and it was with the help of these brothers. They was like the catalyst of a lot of things, and even though, you know, I denounced God, you know, it was these brothers that was like, man, you know, you need a spirituality, man. You got to have faith, man. Hey, man, why are you so angry, man? Why are you so mad, man? Hey. You mad, you know, and they was able to get to me, even though, you know, I denied it at first. But they were, you know, really penetrated the steel that formed from the scars that was around my heart. You know, it turned into steel. I didn't want nothing in. I ain't letting nothing out. But they seized was penetrating. And what happened from that point, you know, I started receiving a lot of feedback from my Internet advert and people, they was reaching out to me, and I was getting my start, you know, from nothing, you know. I was broke down. Everything stripped away, naked. Naked, you know, the peacock that was riding high in the neighborhood, beating on my chest like King Kong with my music, bumping in my truck, saying my slick words through my rap metaphors, you know, with my gold chain to say I accomplished something but accomplished nothing. All this was stripped away, the money, the security. Only thing I had was me. The biggest fight any of you will have to fight is with yourself. Don't tell me, because I know that's the battle. That's the devil. That's God. It's you. You look in the mirror. They look back at you. Can you face who you look at in the mirror? Always could, though. And I think that kind of helped me out because I seen my weaknesses and I was able to grow on them. And, you know, these brothers, they really inspired me a whole lot to really get in there, you know, and be better. You know, it was genuine. You feel what's genuine and you know what's not. You don't trust everybody in prison. These were some good brothers. And I went through this process for years and years, and I'm fighting my case. At this point, I had to get my case to the public defender's office. They backlogged my case for many years. And because I studied the law, I said, you know what? Get off my case. I kicked the little public pretender, you know, in the ass metaphorically to get off my case, and I took over my own case. And this is when serendipity started to occur. Serendipities, you know, while I'm on a search for freedom, I find something else, and I find growth, you know, in myself. But I was finding key evidence. Like, I found out what an eyewitness was after all these years. This is 2006 now. So I find him. I'm like, wow. And I had a supporter at the time, Amy Montgomery in Indianapolis, who had a notary republic. And, you know, being I was pro se, I drew up all the affidavits, all the documents, and, you know, for her to present to him. She knew right where he was at. She went down there to find him. She couldn't find him. And then one day I called her because I'm happy. I'm like, I know she got this statement from this dude. He got the statement. I'm going to get out. I'm happy I called her. And she was like, look, I got some bad news for you, Leon. That witness, I went to, you know, see where he was at in his house, and come to find out he's in a coma. He's been in a car accident, drinking and driving. He's in a coma. I said, they lying. They lying. He just don't want to get involved in the case. She said, wait, hold up. Call the hospital. And he is in the hospital, intensive care. She sent me the paperwork again. I'm like, wow, so I'm mad again. Oh, I'm mad, man. I'm mad. I'm like, wow, I got a right to be mad. I said, all this time, you know, I tell y'all what I need. I don't got my hand. I said, look, this is just what I need. This is what it was from day one. And it seemed like nobody was listening. And now my key witness is in a coma. Am I stuck in prison forever? These are the questions I'm asked. I'm stuck in prison forever. I got a son and a daughter out there, and they ain't gonna see me. When I went in, my son was 1 year old, my daughter was two, and I had another daughter I didn't know about, four at the time. So I'm like, I'm gonna be in fed. This all they gonna know. They pop is in prison, some type of prisoner, you know, a statistic. They made me a statistic, you know, and I was like, wow. But what happened, you know, even though I got over, you know, my anger about that, and I just kept moving on and finding new things, you know, like I told you, serendipity. And I found new things where in 1998, I'm reading the Time magazine, and I bump into an article of a John Barnes, and he's a physicist out of the UK, and he got a new scientific fingerprint technique called visualization of prints, where he can take prints off anything metal. And I thought, I had a flash thought, whoa, man, it's five bullet shells in my case with different brands. I bet you there's a likelihood a print can be got off one of them. the real Killer Brent. I bet you he can. So I reached out to this dude with the help of a few good supporters, and voila, this guy, he's like, look, I'm willing to test your, you know, your evidence and whatnot. We're going to test it just for free, you know, because we're getting started. This is a breakthrough. We were seeing it on CNN that he's going to open up new cold cases. He solved a lot of cold cases with his new technique. So I was elated about that. And also, in 2008, I found out about a new science that came out that was produced by Jeffrey Loftus. He's a professor at Washington, at the University of Washington. He's an experimental psychologist. And he came out with a paper in 2005 called Why Is It Easier to See People Closer Than Far Away? But in his paper, I mean, that's obvious common sense, but in the world of science, you got to prove things. And he proved it. He proved it with a scientific analysis, a distance and vision analysis, where he concluded from his scientific analysis that a human with 20/20 vision cannot recognize a face from 50 yards away in broad daylight. So at night, that distance tripled. So that would be an equivalent of somebody 50 yards. It would be like 150 yards in bad lighting conditions. And he had a blur effect on what a person can see. And, you know, we reached out to him. I had to reach out to another prisoner, Darnell Edwards, who had a case that was going on at the time that I seen on news when I seen this particular evidence. I reached out to him, and this brother, this good brother right here, he sent me a portion of his post-conviction relief. And I seen it. I was like, wow, I got to get in touch with Lotus, Loftus. And I done that, you know, with the help of my brother. We got him. He reviewed the case. He was like, wow. And he gave an affidavit. And he was like, man, ain't no way this eyewitness could have seen anybody from that distance. This woman lying. This is science. And so I bumped into that. So I'm thinking, like, I don't need the CARI. So I'm litigating my own PCR, my post-conviction relief, which is the second phase of your appeal if your direct appeal gets denied. So I'm litigating this myself. I'm in, you know, I'm empowered. I'm in a courtroom when I went to discovery hearings. Hey, I'm out talking to prosecutors. I'm using his language. And it makes me flash back to what a brother once told me when I first came in the joint. And I laughed at him at first. He said, youngster, once you know the language, they can no longer deceive you. I laughed at this brother. I'm like, wow, man, you tripping. But he was telling me about the law. The law is a different language. But you got to take this metaphor a lot further. There's a lot of different languages out there. It's languages of culture, languages of gender, languages of the times, languages of professions, languages of the heart, of the mind, of the soul, and you better be able to speak that language in that particular situation if it really counts, or you can get your life took. And you seen what happened to me. I couldn't speak that language of the law, and I got my freedom took. I tell my sons and my daughters this all the time. Tell them this all the time because it's real. But I started to know the language of the law, and I spoke their language. I went from a brother that was composing hip-hop songs, 16 bars, expressing my vivid experience of the street life and my philosophies, to somebody composing briefs, composing motions, composing whole affidavits and whole legal arguments. And this is what I did. And I was there, and I was empowered. At a particular hearing, the people that was with me, and I salute y'all. I remember the brother Bobby Cole showed up, the sister Minister Ruth Crosby showed up, my sister Siobhan and Valerie, they showed up, and I couldn't let them down. I couldn't let them down. I had to let my people know, like, look, I'm shining, y'all. I'm shining. They can't stop me. I'm shining. I'm a phoenix out the ashes. And I sat there, and I done it with eloquence. and it felt good. Sat them down. But the judge, she got so mad at the people in the crowd that was shaking. And she told one of the supporters that came, ma'am, if you keep shaking your head and agreeing with him, we're going to have to get you out of here. You can't be in my courtroom. And I was like, wow, you know, where that come from? And I knew then, I was like, man, I'm in an uphill battle. This judge, she against me like this. I'm pro se. So I started to seek legal representation. And I was in a courtship with a particular attorney. And, you know, I sent him some money. He run off of my money. And I didn't notice until, like, the day, like a week, 2 weeks before my PCR hearing. But another serendipity, you know, I'm bringing his word up quite often, but this is what happened. This dude, this particular lawyer, he tried to justify stealing the money, and he presented some documents as if he'd done something, and it had a docket sheet in there. So I look at the docket sheet, and it was, it was a later date of the docket sheet that I had of the court activity, and I looked at it. And I seen that my witnesses that I subpoenaed, they were denied, and I didn't know it. So I thought I had these particular witnesses, you know, to present in my PCR hearing, and I didn't have it. Then the judge, she denied my, for me to fingerprint the bullet shells with no explanation or nothing. And I was like, man, I'm in over my head. I got to be real. I don't want to make all. But I can't let these people get me like this, and I had to withdraw. And I withdrew without prejudice. But this allowed my PC to always be litigated, so I preserved that, but I had to get out. I didn't surrender. I retreated. So from that point, I was looking, you know, to fundraise and, you know, get money for a lawyer. And, you know, eventually I ended up getting off the shoe. And I was brought to population for the first time. So I was in solitary for 10 years. 10 years I was in solitary. But you know what? What turned out to be bad turned out to be good for me. When they tried to break me and take my spirit, they only built character. When they tried to break my pride, they made dignity. When they tried to take my mind, they made intellect. So I look at that situation like, wow. That 10 years, I probably had 40 years of education. I probably went through a time warp. It's something that you really can't understand. People see it when they see me, say, wow, something about you. Yeah, 10 years of solitary, you know. But,
right.
You know, beyond
that's
that, you know, things started to come together. And eventually, you know, with the help of my queen, my little queen sis, my baby sis, Valerie, you know, she really stepped up, you know, in the last couple of years and really, you know, came to my aid like, look, bro, I believe in you. And, hey, let's do this. And, you know, we really hooked up, you know, and we were able to, you know, come together and fundraise, you know, a couple thousand dollars. And I was able to hire a good lawyer, which is the lawyer that I got now. His name is Eric Kasuki. And, he's a very good lawyer. We checked his background, and he real good. He took the case. I met with him here in December. Phenomenal guy, you know. I'm a good judge of character at this point, and he really highlighted, you know, big points about my case and about what's going to give me relief. And, you know, he says it's a home run. He just want to finish up doing certain things with interviewing the witnesses because obviously – not obviously, but miraculously, that eyewitness that was in a coma, you see, he came back. He woke up out of this coma, and he looked for me. He found me.
Wow.
Truth never dies. It's
okay.
Only discovered.
And
I was like, wow. And he come back behind me, and he put it together.
We got the line lit up for you tonight, Leon. We want to go to some of these callers, and you've been doing a great, great, great message, man, you know what I mean, for the people. Now we want the people to weigh in, you know? So,
hey, all right.
We're going to my missus start
That's
going
cool.
down the block.
Yeah, we have the system lit up. We have lots of people in the chat room listening, so we just appreciate all the support, and we're going to try to get to as many callers as we can. We're going to go first to your brother, Rod, and he's the oldest of your siblings, and he's going to speak out a little bit on the family and what they went through during your trial and through those difficult times. So, Rod, welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you guys doing? Can you hear me?
We're doing good,
yeah,
and can hear you great.
Clear.
Hey, first of all, I just wanted to say thanks to you guys for providing a platform for those who are seeking justice for their voices to be heard. So I really appreciate what you guys are doing.
Thank you much.
So
and
tell us
I'll
bit
just
about
answer your
what
questions.
Your family went through during that time.
Well, you know, something interesting happened about a week before. I think Leon and I were both home at the same time. I was in the military at the time, and I was home on leave, and I was actually doing a recruiting help in Flint, Michigan. And, you know, it was a few weeks before this incident happened, and I think I always kind of felt a little guilty about the fact that there was a time where I came home and Leon and a friend of his got pulled over, and but it was right in front of the house where they got stopped at, and the police had cuffed him up, and you know, and so I got out, I was in uniform, and I never really took the side of my brother. If he was in trouble, I figured he must have done something, you know, to draw the attention. And, you know, but I talked to the police, and for some reason they decided to let him go. And I always kind of felt a little guilty about, you know, if he would have probably have been either taken, whatever they were going to do, it wasn't going to be nothing serious. But, you know, if they would have just even locked him up for a few days, maybe this would have never, you know, never happened. You know, he would never been down, he would never gone back to Indiana to be down there in this situation. Needless to say, you know, we were all very shocked. You know, it's kind of when you read about these things or you see it on television about someone going to prison for something that they didn't do, and just to hear what had happened with the type of crime that it was. You know, I was living pretty much a different life at the time, and but, you know, I knew that life very well in Flint that, you know, Leon just described to y'all. And, you know, to come back and experience him, you know, sitting in court, you know, I knew my brother very well. I mean, I knew that he, you know, the type of lifestyle he led. But I'd never in all our time, and I even spent time with him in Indiana, you'd never been a violent person, never. You know, the thing that he talked about was rapping, and I felt like, you know, that probably was something that he was going to end up doing because he was very good at it. But, you know, I understood, you know, having to try to survive the streets. So to see him in court for murder was, you know, very shocking. And, you know, so everybody is going to, I don't care what they say, they're going to have their doubts. And I'm going to tell you how my doubts were erased when, you know, I actually went and spent time on Pennsylvania Avenue. I talked to people who were there that night. I looked at the crime scene myself. I read the affidavits. I went to the apartment of where one of the witnesses spoke in the affidavit that they saw the whole thing happen, which if you'd go to that apartment, and matter of fact, there is video footage of it. You cannot even see the crime scene. So the folks that he talked about, the older woman that and her husband that they used to visit, I mean, I met all those people. And he never was out to talk to any of these people, and his story was the same as what these folks said. So you know, if you go to where we're sitting at in court now, to know all those things, to know that, you know, that he's innocent, to know that there are people out there who could free him, and to know that the people who are supposed to represent the public, you know, the Detective Jones is whom I spoke with, who also had doubt about his guilt, that they still wouldn't do the right thing, you know, and to see and let all this kind of transpire, you feel very helpless. You know, there's nothing that you can do. I don't know how to really describe the feeling, you know, to give someone, unless you've gone through this, to give them something that's similar. But, you know, I can tell you that I said, well, you know, there's always a chance that he could be found guilty. Anytime you sit in court, it could happen to anybody. You know, but anytime you sit in court, you could be found guilty. But, you know, when I looked at the evidence, I looked at what they were trying to prove, and I thought, you know, he's got to have a better than 80% chance of getting off. But as I sat in that courtroom, I'm going to tell you, there's a few things that kind of jumped out at me. You know, the one thing that we always talk about is that you'll be in court, you'll be judged by a jury of your peers. I looked over in that jury, and I probably saw one person that was his peer. And that person eventually was relieved as a juror. The other thing was that I, during a recess, the judge was speaking to a class of students who were coming through on a field trip. And, you know, I always thought people in positions of responsibility were, you know, would generally be fair and balanced. And this judge made no qualms about telling these students how she felt that he was guilty and that, you know, that he needed to be put away. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, we're in the middle. This isn't even at the end of the court session. And these things, this happened. And, you know, for me, I was somebody who believed in I really was somebody who believed in the system. I mean, I'm a decorated veteran. I have a master's degree. I've gone through, you know, schools, and I was an officer. I really believed in the uniform justice of this this country, and you know, to see that happening, it was a real eye opener. You know, you read about it, you hear about it, you hear about people getting put in away, but you never really think it's gonna happen to somebody that you know. And, you know, and I saw, you know, the spirit of you guys' website, and I want to tell people, you know, the kids that are out there that are listening, you know, one of the things that I know that got my brother, and we talked about it while he was in jail, and he'll tell you himself, is that he didn't think that this could happen, you know, that he could get put away. He was innocent. And a lot of that comes from just not being educated about the legal system. And, you know, none of us really had any real education about, you know, what we were up against and what we should have done as far as the lawyers that we should have gotten and the strategies that we should have taken. But, you know, the real scary part is that if you get wound up in this system, you could get gotten. And really, once you get in the middle of it, it's going to be very difficult for you to find your way out. It's almost like quicksand, you know, and very few people can't put out anything to you once you get in the middle of it to pull you out. So, you know, you need to think about all your decisions that you make, even if it means that, you know, you may be doing something illegal. You may be put in jail for something that you didn't do. But just being in proximity of things that are going on that can wind you up there, you're putting yourself at risk. You know, but, you know, that I can tell you that the one word that we all felt as a family was helpless. We felt like we could not help him in that situation.
You know, and there's so many people out there, or in there, I should say, that are in there wrongly and unjust, and are helpless. And some of us out here, we don't know what to do either because we haven't had to go through that system. And so, I don't know. I just feel so bad for the people that are in there that don't belong there because I know that there are a lot of them. And I don't know where the system got, well, the system's broke. It's been broke for a long time. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I mean, I've sat on a jury myself, and I've seen somebody who was, I mean, they were all the way guilty, get let loose. I mean, a judge came in and told us who the person was afterwards, you know, and you feel bad about those situations. But, you know, one of the guys that's on the jury pool that I was on said, he said something that hey, you know, we'd rather let somebody go that is guilty than to put somebody away that, you know, is innocent. And, you know, and there's very few people out there that think that way, you know, but the thing is that if you get caught up in that system, you know, even with all the outlets that, like you guys provide, I mean, we're trying to get some momentum here. We need to get some people behind this to give him another shot in court. I mean, that's what he needs. He needs another shot.
Right.
And I think anybody who's reasonable will look at this evidence and see the truth. I mean, I think he's explained it enough on what he saw. I'll be willing to send you guys the affidavit from Dr. Loftus. You read the evidence yourself, the testimonies. You would think that a 5-year-old could figure out right and wrong in this court. And, you know, and I felt bad for that family. I mean, we were very empathetic to their situation. But I can tell you, in a lot of cases, what it seemed like is that everybody just wanted somebody that they could pin it on. And at that time, no one was really thinking. You know, they just want to put somebody away.
And that's the bottom line. A lot of times you got prosecutors that just want to say next case, you know, and don't want to really look at the whole situation. And me and my wife did a write-up on two people already who had been exonerated, a young man out of California who served 19 years for a case he didn't commit, and the prosecutor admitted that he threw the evidence up under the table, and he just put him in there because he was a gangbanger, you know, and he wasn't trying to pay attention to all of the facts there. So these prosecutors, from what my opinion is, that if you locking up people and throwing away evidence, that same time that young man or young woman have served, you need to go in jail and serve that time too, because you're a hypocrite, you know what I mean? And you shouldn't be above the law, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't be above the law. And I just wanted
it's
to point out
to
one.
That.
Yeah, and I just wanted to point out one other thing. Is that when I heard about Leon's case and other people's cases, you know, I watched that ID channel a lot. And there was a lady that committed a crime in Cincinnati, Ohio, in 1958. She lured a woman into a park, shot her in the head, and set her on fire with gasoline. And this was evidence that was facts. This wasn't nothing they had to go look for. This was facts. And they found her guilty, gave her a death row sentence. She came from being on death row to life in prison, from life in prison to serving 12 years. And I'm looking at the TV like, where in the hell they do this at in America, you know? And you got guys in jail that ain't even committed a crime. But you come from death row to life, to 12 years in prison and come home, you know?
And yeah, you did the crime.
This woman in the head. Yeah, you actually shot this woman in the head and set her on fire with gasoline. Now, it's a problem with that there, you know? It's a big problem with that.
Yeah. Well, Rod, we want you to hold on here with us. We're going to keep you on, but we want to bring on, we're going to bring on Walter. This is one of the men that Leon was speaking about. And he spent some time in the SHU with them, and he served 16 years on a 110-year sentence for a double murder that he did not commit. He was recently exonerated in 2010, and he now has a suit against the city. Let's welcome Walter to the show. You there, Walter?
Hello. Hello.
Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
We're good. How are you? Congratulations on getting out.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate it. Happy to be free.
Leon, you still there?
Happy to be free.
Leon?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody's on. Well, tell us your perspective, Walter. And
Actually, me and 440 have very similar stories. Actually, hearing a story, it kind of it was real eerie and gave me goosebumps, even though it's cold out here where I'm at a little bit. But it gave it even more of a chill because it resonated back what I had to go through, what I endured, you know. So firstly, I want to say, I want to encourage you, 440, to keep your head up, man. Stay strong.
I appreciate that, bro.
But, yeah, when we met in the shoe, we both had similar situations. We both was locked up for something we didn't do, but then we was locked up while we was locked up for something we didn't do. You know, he had some kind of prison situation with the prison guard, and I had some kind of situation with the drug case. So he did like 10 years in the shoe. I did like 6. I actually got released from the shoe. My last 6 years was actually in the shoe. But yeah, I fought hard. I did everything I could to get up out of there. Everybody out here was hurting. Nobody really can help as far as assistance. So, you know, I did what I had to do. And I made it home, and I'm happy. You know what I mean?
My man. Now, can you tell these young folks out here what is the shoe like, you know?
You don't want to be there. Like that, you don't want to be there. You talk about losing all your Please just bear with me. I get emotional, you know what I mean?
Hey, take your time, good brother, you feel me? Because when you let live that life, it's an emotional roller coaster. So take your time, my friend.
You talk about not being able to sleep at night, all night, everybody hooping and hollering, arguing about stupid shit, you know what I mean? Dudes throwing piss and shit at police, getting on lockdown because another motherfucker do something stupid. Keep in mind, you already locked up something you didn't do already. So shit already difficult as it is. But you got to dig down deep, I mean, to the deepest, to your core, to hold on, to maintain your sanity. Because if you don't, you're straight loser. I promise you, you're a straight loser. I've seen some hardcore, straight street thugs, straight loser. Don't have sense of direction right now. Drugged up. They played crazy for so damn long, they really are crazy now. It'll tear you apart. I applaud 448 for a struggle, for what you've been through, bro. Hey, we here for you, bro. We here for you.
Hey, I feel you. I feel you in Dugo. I feel you 100%, man. You know, a lot of people that didn't experience, you know, that stuff in the show, you know, I try to be kind of poetic with it. But, you know, this brother right here, he shed in my tears. He shed in my tears and my pain. I got the same pain. But I tell y'all, though, you know, I'm on the battlefield. So right now, I hold my tears back, you know, and I refuse to cry. I don't want to cry in the face of my oppressors, the people that keep me here.
I'm
but you seen it.
I'm at them now. I met him down in Dugu, like I said, man. This bread come through, man, I met you. You already know, we talked about it.
Hey, I already know, brother. Hey, I already know, man. But, hey, what's even bigger, you know, why I asked you to come on and talk for me is you made it out. So, y'all out there, y'all need to see, you know, it's a difficult struggle, but he made it out. He made it out with persistence.
Amen.
Out as well, Leon. You're going to make it out.
Almost gave up a long time ago. Almost gave up. I mean, like, I had one tear. My day was 2050. 2050, every day I live with that. 2050. I had this thing on my wall that my mom made for me. They remind me every day that I was innocent. And not to let them consume me. And when I made it out of there, I heard a lot of them brothers, it gave them a lot of hope. Because you don't overcome it like that. You don't supposed to.
Right.
You don't supposed to do that. That's not how it's supposed to happen. That's not, they don't supposed, you don't supposed to win. But in reality, like you said, the truth never dies. The truth never dies.
Never dies.
A lie runs sprints, but the truth runs marathons. The truth gonna be there.
Show you, buddy.
The truth gonna be there, bro. You just stay in there, bro. Whatever Most High got in store for you, bro, that's what's gonna happen. They keep talking what they wanna talk. Look, when my case went to the Seventh Circuit, they didn't know they was gonna vote in that tweet and let me on. I ain't either.
So
let me check that court record and find out. And they said let me go. It wasn't no 1-2 vote. Everybody voted. Y'all fucked up. Let that man up out of y'all fucked up.
And now, the day that they came to the shoe, you said you got out from the shoe, right?
I was released from the shoe. If you go online, you'll see my picture walking out from the shoe with me holding my fist up with the police. You push my shit to the car. I ain't pushing shit. You push my shit. My mom out there waiting for me. I ain't pushing the motherfucking thing. Yeah, I have me locked up here. My pictures are online right now. They got the dash. They selling my pictures. I bought my own pictures online from them.
Hey, I feel you with Dugu. And that
they took pictures of me online.
I was
released from the shoot. And you ain't supposed to do that. Right now, I'm probably going through psychological evaluation and things for my lawsuit because you don't just release a motherfucker from that into society like that. I hadn't had human contact in 6 years before I was released.
Oh, wow.
6 years. The first person I touched in 6 years was my mother. You look online, you're going to see that picture of me hugging the embrace of my mother, crying, kissing my mother for the first time in 17 years.
Wow.
I bought that picture too, by the way. They sold me that picture. That's all right. It was worth it.
Without a doubt, you know. So what would be your, words to wisdom to a lot of these young cats out here, you know, that's calling themselves wanting to be thugs and gangsters?
I'm going to tell you my biggest pitfall in my case, if one go research my case, my biggest pitfall, and I got it on my neck now. Like young cats now, they fall into the pitfalls of my homeboy this, my homeboy that, the hood this, the hood that. As we speak, and 440, I didn't get a chance to talk to you about this yet. But as we speak, I broadcast this live on radio. I'm struggling. Just a few days ago, I learned that my son is facing a murder right now that he didn't commit. Murder, robbery. Talk about deja vu.
Wow.
This case, too. You research this case. DeAndre Gowdy. He's in Portland right now. I'm going to head up there to go help him fight this shit. And I go hold my son like that. I know what he's up against right now. I know what he's going to face. The man talked to me like, Dad, I didn't do it. I said, it's all good. I feel you. This is what I try to talk to you about. He's 1 year old when I went in. I wrote many, 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 many letters. Watch your so-called homeboys. That ain't your homeboys. Your family is your homies.
Wow.
But that homeboy shit. That homeboy shit ain't shit. That ain't shit. When you sitting up in there, you're going to see who's going to see you. Who's going to see you? That's your own voice. Your mama, that's going to see you. Your daddy, if he's there, that's going to see you. Your family, that's who's going to see you. That homeboy shit ain't shit. They go out the window.
Amen.
Let me tell you about homeboys. My so-called homeboy, the motherfucker that did the murder, got on the stand and told him that I did the shit. And they let him get away with it.
Wow.
They made a deal with the devil. They knew they did it. That's what got me home. Now, I had evidence to show that they put this dude in the lineup and everybody pointed him out as being the one who did it. And they knew he did it.
Damn.
This is my homeboy, though. My best friend.
Wow.
That's what I got for you. You ain't got no homeboys, but your family's your homeboys.
Mm-hmm.
Leave that shit alone. Get your education. That's what's going to get you somewhere in life. Period.
Okay.
My son just turned 20. On his 20th birthday, he finds himself, now you turn around, you facing a damn murder. Murder, robbery. Period.
Wow.
Same time of the year. This time of the year, 1994, I got locked up for this same shit.
Wow.
February 1994. And here he go. Now he's facing this.
Damn.
But
and
he was thugging out there.
He's
one of you out there with dreadlocks. I mean, I ain't stereotyping because you can have what you want to have. But I said the past sagging with the hat, you know, my this, that, you know, and I ain't going to broadcast where you're from because it don't matter where you're from. But the bottom line, you Facebook and your homie this, homie that, my homie's this, your homie's that. Where your homie's at now? Your homie's the one who's couldn't testify against your fucking ass. Excuse my language.
Hey, we keep it real, bro. Talk, baby.
So that just, I mean, it just pissed me off, man, because, like I said, we want to sit out here and then we sit here and try to tell you and tell you and tell you and tell you. You don't want to listen. Even if you find yourself in that situation, now you want to cry, oh, hell, what you mean? We've been trying to tell you. We're trying to tell you now. Reach out to the ones who know, who've been there. I be trying to reach out right now every time I can, reach out and talk to somebody who going through this right now. Anybody who going through the streets right now, I be trying to reach out right now. Listen to somebody who been there, man. I just came home 16 years for somebody to do, homie. 16 years.
Yeah.
And mind you, and what your brother said, ring volumes. Ain't no way in hell I thought they could have found me guilty of this. There's no way in the world. I'm innocent. There ain't no way in the world you can find me guilty. I had the biggest head in the world during trial. I ain't gonna lie. My head was swollen during trial. God. My money was all. Ain't no way in the world you can find me guilty. I ain't did nothing. The jury came back guilty. 2 weeks worth of evidence. Came back guilty in 4 hours. 2 weeks worth of evidence. 4 hours.
Now what happened to the guy who testified to you? Did they lock his ass up?
They let him go. They made a deal with the devil. He was a nobody. So they didn't want him. It was about me. I was the man on the street. You know, I did what I was doing. I was the same way as Fourth Way he talked about. I'm from out west. I came out there, willing and dealing, doing my thing in the streets. You kept trying to knock me for this. You could never knock me for this. You turned around and put a murder on me. You knew I didn't commit. You knew damn well I didn't commit. This wasn't even my M.O. You look nowhere in my record. Nowhere in my record is showing that type of violence, that type of thing. Even
right.
In my prison record. Nowhere in my prison record. I've been on lockup half my prison time, and nowhere in my prison record I got violence. Nowhere. But it kept me on lockup like I was straight up. And I knew it had nothing. I knew it wasn't nothing more than the prosecutor because he had ties to that prison, and there ain't no doubt in my mind. They say what they want to say, and that's why they kept messing with me like that, kept shaking me down. Kept throwing me in the hole. The whole 16 years, I had like 5 write-ups, and none of them major. None of them.
Wow.
Well, Walter, hang on with us for a minute. We have another guest that we need to bring on for the end of the show.
Hang on with us for a few more minutes.
I don't know who I am.
Huh?
All right. Yeah, I'm right here at 7-11 on the phone.
All right, we're going to go to the next
caller.
Where you at?
Okay. We're going to go, and we still have Rod on the line with us, hanging in here for till the end. We're going to go to Miss Kim Dini. She has been working on the Sarah Cruzan case, and she's a supporter, and we just want to get her perspective on the wrongful incarceration of people. Let's see. Let me get you on. Hang on just a second. Miss Kim, are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Thank you for being in there with us till the end. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So can you give us your perspective and what you've gone through in trying to help Sarah Cruzan?
Well, in listening to everything that everyone said, I didn't get the other guy's name. Was it Walter?
Walter.
And Leon's brother. It all paints a clear picture in my head about how important it is for us to speak up for the voiceless. You know, we know these things transpire. We know that people are sentenced unjustly. We know all of these things happen, yet so often we don't do anything. Like, we have to be a voice for the voiceless. Now, as it relates to Sarah Cruzan, I met her in 1994 when I myself was incarcerated. She was my cellmate, and she was a victim of human trafficking.
Yeah.
In this particular case, she...
Story. Exactly.
I'm sorry?
I'm familiar with her story, and
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, in 1994, she had already been incarcerated for 10 years. But when I met her, no one had heard her story. You know, she was just a girl, another girl in prison, who was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 4 years on top of that. And she was sentenced to that as a juvenile. Her trial lasted for 1 week, where she was convicted in 1 week without any expert witness, testimony, nothing. She was railroaded. The only difference in her case is that she did kill the guy who had trafficked her. He was 33 years old. And like I said, she was a victim of human trafficking. For those who are not aware of the term human trafficking, this man took her out on the streets and basically groomed her to be a child prostitute. Right.
Right.
So, you know, in this particular case, as it relates to Leon, you know, we have someone who has spent all these years in prison for a crime that he did not commit. As it relates to Sarah, she did commit the crime, and now here we are 18 years later, and she will finally be released. And how we
That's
got
awesome.
To that point is because, you know, when I came home, I had known her for about a year, and I promised her when I got out, I promised I'm going to do everything I can to help you. And I'm going to get you out of here. That's what I told her. I told her I'm going to get her out of there. You know, through attorneys that we later got and through campaigns that I started and just kind of getting her story out there, this is where we're at in 2012. She'll be released probably within the next 6 months. And this is someone who was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. She thought she was going to die in prison.
Wow.
So
I
want to get you guys back on the show soon. But, you know, she was a victim of child abuse, you know, prostitution, trafficking, and she was sentenced to life as a child. She was a teenager.
Right.
She's the victim. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
She was a victim, you know, but... What I can appreciate is that, you know, look where we're at now. And if I never came home and I just forgot about her and, you know, didn't do anything, she would still be in there fighting for her life. And maybe not even fighting, just had, you know, gave up. So, you know, I met Leon. I heard about him a few months ago. And after all these many years of fighting for Sarah, it's something that I always had within me, you know, because I was a juvenile who was always in trouble, you know, incarcerated at a very early age. I was also, too, railroaded. I understand the system, and I understand how they treat us. I understand how they sentence us to unfair sentences, you know, whereas someone else may get something much less for something that we may get more time for. I'm sorry if I kind of rambled that, but...
No, we understand.
You know, with Leon, I met him, and his story really resonated with everything that I have fought for within my own life, fought for Sarah, fought for other people. We cannot sentence anyone to prison who did not commit the crime. And if they are in there, we need to fight for them. All it takes is for us to raise awareness. You know, that's all I did. I used the internet for years with Sarah. Until now, I have supporters all over the world. I mean, I set up her website. I had no clue what I was doing. You know, and I started seeing the analytics of it, and I started watching people pop up from Guam and China. And I'm sitting in awe. I remember writing to her like, oh my God, like, you know, people are like checking in from all kinds of different countries all over the world, like checking out your story. All it takes is for us to be a voice. And without our voice, you know, it's hard for them in there. You know, the communication, the, like Walter said, he was in, you know, solitary confinement for years without any communication to the world. We have to speak up for our innocent, and we have to speak up for the cases that are just unjust.
That's right.
So,
and
you know,
just by being a voice and getting that message out there, I think the more that the people have a voice on the outside, the easier it's going to be for the justice system to say, well, let's just let them go and let's get on with something else. Or, you know, they don't want to have that that loud voice, I guess, making trouble. So they just want
to try to move
it on.
No, they don't. If we didn't,
no, we need more loud voices making trouble. We need more people that fight for justice, because there's way too much injustice in this United States. Way too much. There's way too many people incarcerated for nonviolent crimes, unjustly, and we need more people to speak up.
If we didn't fight for Sarah the way that we did, if we didn't stand on the halls of juvenile hall, if we didn't do light brigades, you know, over freeways, if we didn't do everything we could to, you know, stir up and cause, you know, attention and you know, bring awareness to her case, it would still be the same thing. And so that's where we're at with Leon's case. Like, we have to bring awareness to his case. Like, we're going to do all that it takes, you know, through campaigns, and maybe we should give out that information, Leon, before we go.
Definitely.
Okay.
If you have any information, definitely give that out now.
Well, if you want to, you know, really connect with my campaign, you can go to www.freewebs.com/freeleonbenson. If you want to purchase my book, Eye of the Storm, please go to www.eyeofthestormleonbenson.wordpress.com. Also, lastly, if you know, by luck of Yahweh, you know, I've been able to get my voice out and talk to the people. If you want to, you know, hear my voice, see the videos and stuff like that of different poetry, of struggle, of different perspectives, go to www.youtube.com/LeeBentley, BENTLY, Lee Bentley, and you can be informed about my case and be in the loop.
Awesome. Okay. We do have a couple more callers, and we just want to thank you, Kim, for coming on and spending this time with us and staying on till the very end and being able to share your message. And I have your number. Is this a good number to get back at you?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
And it's a pleasure to be here, especially speaking on behalf of Leon. You know, we really want to see him free. We want him to be our next.
Well, we're
going to
work with you and help you
freedom.
Out. So let's get you on the show, and let's get some more loud voices going.
Okay. Thank you.
So thank you so much. I'm going to put you back on hold for a minute. We have a couple more callers. I just want to give them an opportunity to make a comment or if they have a question. We're going to go to a caller. The last four digits are 4529. Last four digits, 4529. Caller, are you on the air? Okay. We'll go to the next caller. Last four digits, 1837. Caller, you're on the air.
I want to get on the call.
Caller? Okay, I guess they're just listening in tonight.
Yeah,
I just wanted to give them that chance.
Yeah, what I want to say is, you still there, 448?
Hey, I'm still here. I'm still here, Ron.
Dig this here, man. Hey, your story is very, very compelling, brother, and your homeboy that did them 16 calendars. Tonight, man, you know, we're going to take a slow down pause, and I'm going to dedicate this song to you and your Conrad, man. It's called Never Give Up, man, by my homeboy, OG Suicide, out of California, man. So I want you to lean back and all the viewers lean back. And anybody that's going through anything, I want you to really listen to this track right here. And it's called Never Give Up. We'll be right back with my main man, Leon. All right.
All right. And this starts out with him on the basketball court.
Look, homies, what's good with y'all?
What's up with y'all, huh?
What's good?
Can't make no shots, man.
Can't make no shots. I mean, you know, can't give up, though. You got to keep trying, you know? Practice makes perfect.
I know.
You know, that's for all y'all. You know what I mean? Just, you know, stay focused. Don't give up. You know, never give up. No matter what it is in life, you can't give up on anything. That's real. You know what I mean? So just keep your shot going. All y'all, you know.
Okay.
I look forward to coming to the game one day. NBA, man. I'm trying to see y'all there.
Yeah.
All right? Okay, low ones. Y'all be good, all right? I just came to check on y'all.
That's
all
right.
Keep believing. Never give up.
back here to the streets. I love you back. Hottest radio show around the world. We're kicking it live with my main man, Lee Benson, in the house. And he's definitely telling me about this straight-up injustice that he has occurred and many others have occurred before him. But as we know, God is always good, and we can never give up pushing at what we know is real out here in this place we call America. So we're right back with my main man, Leon, you know?
Hey, how y'all doing, man? Hey, Rob, Lucinda, Kim, Walter, Ron, and everybody out there listening, you know, I want to thank y'all for, you know, pouring out the support for me. You know, even more, you know, I want to thank y'all for, you know, believing in me and believing in my innocence. You know, I want to tell y'all that, you know, the purpose of me stepping out and, you know, doing this interview was to show y'all that, you know, one can be strong in this situation, that, you know, I'm pushing the ball. This situation is not hopeless. It's a hard one, but it's not hopeless. It's definitely a lot of opportunities for justice and for exoneration and things of that nature to occur. And I want to let y'all know that, I mean, you can join, you know, my movement. We are really going places. We got the lawyer on the team. We're going to push this PCR in a month or two. We're going to drop that, and we're going to let the people know what's going on with the case. We got the evidence. We got the eyewitnesses. We got all these things in this case. However, we need your support to make sure that justice is served. So we need people to, you know, step up and stand out and, you know, let it be known that this is a travesty of justice, that this thing is happening, and we don't want it to happen no more. So we need you guys up there, out there in the world, you know, to step up and, you know, really engage, you know, my Truth Never Dies movement, because we can stop these officials from their corruption and what they're doing. Also, I want to let you know that, you know, beyond my time here, you know, when I get out, you know, I'm going to be for the people. This is my particular purpose that comes from my particular tragedy. You find triumph in tragedy, and this is my particular triumph. When I get out, I'm going to be for the people. I got to be for people who live the life that I live. I can reach them. I'm the voice of authenticity. I live it. I walk it, so I can talk it. And I got the right to criticize dudes that's out there that's doing the wrong thing, and I think they'll listen to me like they listen to me here. So I really encourage y'all to join my movement. And I also want to thank supporters out there who's really, you know, who didn't, you know, particularly get out, you know, get on and express their voice, because there's a lot of people that helped me out through the years, and I really appreciate you. R.I.P. to Carla Andrews, Cut Your Prome, Lita Grace, the brother Steve Willett. I want to give a shout out to Darcy Delaposa. I want to give a shout out to the Lady of Judah, the Judicial Justice Movement. I want to give a special shout out to Ann Wright, to Carolina Salsa. I want to give a shout out to Lisa Taylor. And I want to give a shout out to Luke, to Luke Charles, to my family, my sister Val, my bro, my sons, my daughters. You know, all the people that stood by me that was there. I want to give a shout out to the people that looked back, that got out the joint, that got out of prison, who looked back, who was real on their word. That's what's up, because that's all we got is our word and what we can do. And I appreciate all y'all. I want to let you know, ain't nothing you done is in vain, and I'm still fighting, and I'm still fighting, and there got to be a reason that I'm still here. So I want to give my biggest thanks and my biggest praise to the Most High, Yahweh, because without him, I won't be here talking to you. Without him, I wouldn't have the strength to get up out of the bed, the strength to reach out to my people, to reach out to the world. So I thank you, Yahweh, and I thank everybody out there for tuning in.
My man, you know, and we definitely appreciate you being able to come on the show.
and doing your thing, Lee. So
definitely.
We definitely
Thank
appreciate
you so much.
That.
I appreciate that, y'all.
Without a doubt, man. So let them know where to go get your book at again, Lee, before we get off the line. Let them know where to go grab your book again and where to join your movement again.
You can grab my book. I mean, it's a phenomenal book. It's poetic, but it's real. It's called The Eye of the Storm, Eye of the Storm, you know. And you can go buy it at www.eyeofthestormleonbenson.wordpress.com. Also, you can go on Facebook and join my cause page, Free Leon Benson or Free Leon Benson Group. And you can join, you know, my movement there, and you can get into the loop with good supporters that's out there doing their thing, Shay Doon and, you know, others that's really been supporting me out there where, you know, I can't see none of this stuff, you know. I'm like a caveman almost, but they keep me in tune with everything, with what's going on, and I really appreciate it. And you guys can go there and join the movement. And what I want to do more than anything is we want the people to come out. You know, we do the online thing. You know, that's cool. We want the people to come out. We want the people to really get involved. You know, we got T-shirts. We got rallies planned. And we want the people to come out and show support and really do it instead of, you know, hitting likes on Facebook and giving shots out. We need to really make this thing move because not only will you assist me, you assisting the brother that's going to get out and assist others. And I will show them, like, the brother here, Mr. Rob Boyd, you know, he got a piece called The Streets Don't Love You Back. But it's brothers like him, me, and others that can reach the youth. That's my particular lot that I believe the Creator put me in to do that, and that's what I feel like my purpose to do. So when I get out of here, you know, I got to show the cautionary tales of my situation and try to prevent other youth and other people from falling in the same traps.
We appreciate that, Lee, man, and I want to appreciate that. You know, Lee also had, you know, a great grace to order the book, and he received the book, and he is very, you know, pleased with the message that he got out of the book, you know, because I didn't glamorize me and my homeboy's life, you know. At the end of my story, I wanted people to understand this is what happens when you call yourself in that street life, you know. At the end of the day, it's either death or the penitentiary. It's no in-between. It's no I'm finna ride off into the sunset. And like my man said, it ain't even about no homeboys, because through life, you'll see they'll turn on you too, you know? So
yeah.
You just got to be aware of your surroundings, and you got to understand that education is the key to any type of success, because a dumb man or dumb woman don't succeed in this place we call America.
Or the world, you know?
That's right.
That's real. So we appreciate you, Lee, man, you know, and I'll turn the mic over to the missus.
We're out of time, and we just want to thank everybody. We had, you know, the switchboard is lit up. There was the chat room was full. There's a lot of people listening. So we know that your message is going to get out there, you know, even wider than it is now. And we just thank everybody for your support. And please pass on the message, pass on the websites. And please join us at thestreetsdontloveyouback.ning.com. And join us live here every Wednesday night, 8:30 Pacific time, 11:30 Eastern time. And we want you to all to have a great week. And any last shout-outs, Boyd, for you?
Oh, yeah, I just want to thank everybody for tuning into the radio show tonight and thanking everybody for just, you know, riding with us with the movement and educating these kids and stopping them before they, like Lee said, before they get into the system, you know? So we would just like to thank everybody for that, you know?
Okay. We want you all to have a great week. Join us back here next Wednesday night. And remember, the streets don't love you back. Good night.